So, Vim, thank you very much indeed for joining us on this occasion. This is part of a new series of interviews which we're doing with leading figures within the Europaeum. And you have been, of course, involved in the evolution of the Europaeum for a very long part of its life. The Europaeum itself is about 33 years old, and I think for around that half that time or so, you've been actively engaged at different levels in its work. But before we go on to talk about that in any detail, tell us something about yourself, your own intellectual journey, your own contribution to higher education in the Netherlands.
Yes, thank you very much, Anthony, for having me. Yes, I think I've been involved with the Europaeum since the early days of the 21st century. Yeah? So 2004, I think I got involved, which is now already more than 20 years, I'm afraid. At that time, I was a very young and promising historian, just appointed to the chair of general history, as it was called in the Netherlands, mainly dealing with imperial, what is called world history or imperial history or whatever you want to call it. I'm working on the decolonization of the Dutch East Indies. And I was asked by somebody in the administration of Leiden University, one of the founding members of the Europaeum, to get involved into what I think already then was called the Academic Council. So I was a promising historian, and that career was broken by the Rector Magnificus and President of Leiden University, who actually in 2007, so 3 years later, asked me to become Dean of the Faculty of Humanities, which was in crisis at that moment at Leiden University. So after 3 years in my professorship, I became Dean of the Faculty. Of course, that's killing for an academic career, or if you want to call deanship academic career, that's okay. But I became yes, I became an administrator in the, in that sense, working for a great faculty, actually, you know, with all the beautiful disciplines, as from Assyriology to new media and everything in between. And from that position, I tried to support the Europaeum. We did a lot of things together with other partners, setting up joint master programs within the European context, for instance, with Prague University. And I could support that, of course, also as a dean of the faculty, which I did for 10 years, awfully long. And then I became member of the board of the Dutch Research Council, which is again an administrative job, which actually gave me the liberty to write a book again. So this is after 10 years of deanship, I started to write a book on somebody nobody knows at sea, outside the Netherlands, who is called Christian Snoeker-Groenje. Christian Snoeker-Groenje is a very famous Orientalist from Leiden, one of the first Western scholars visiting Mecca in the 1880s, making pictures of Mecca, writing beautiful book in German about Mecca, very world famous book. And then he became an advisor of the colonial government, fighting a guerrilla war with the people of Aceh, being advisor on all kinds of Islamic affairs in Indonesia. And then he returned to the Netherlands to become professor of Arabic at Leiden University. Awful man for his PhD students, who complained. All of them complained about his harsh manners. But at that time, in the 20s and 30s, it was not a problem, I presume. So this is my intellectual background, so to speak. I never thought to be able to write a biography, actually, because I thought, well, it's not. You need a kind of psychological insights. I don't presume I have them myself, but well, my publisher actually, he forced me to do it, and so there is this biography of Snoeker-Groenje, which you can also read in Indonesian. It's has been translated into Indonesian, which I preferred than to over translation into English, actually, because it's more relevant in Indonesia, this biography, than perhaps in the UK.
And did you find it more difficult to write a biography than conventional history?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Because, well, you are always depending on the always depending as a historian on the sources, of course. But as a bio you, if you want to write a biography, you need the personal, more personal letters, huh? So not just the policy papers or whatever, but you need personal letters. And unfortunately, I could find them. It's a long story because he married twice in Indonesia, got children which were not recognized for as Europeans, but they were Indonesians, and he left them behind. There were letters written in Arabic script, but in Sundanese, which is the language of Western Java, which I showed to the present professor of Arabic at Leiden, and she, I said, yeah, can you tell me what's in there? And she started reading it, and of course she couldn't make anything out of it because it's not Arabic. It's Sundanese, but written in Arabic handwriting, which, and then in these letters, the personal information about his children and so on were, in a way, secretly transmitted to the Netherlands, where he was married again. So he had three wives, and a daughter who could not read these letters, of course, because they were in Arabic and in Sundanese.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, you mentioned that Leiden has been involved in the EuroPem from the very start. What would you say has been the sort of added value, if you like, and contribution that the EuroPem has made, not only to your own university, but more widely to higher education across Europe?
Yes, I think this has evolved over the years. Obviously, everything evolves over the years. And at a certain moment, I think the EuroPem concentrated on students, and instead of just having the one conference after another, which was, I think, more of the early years of the EuroPem, so exchanges, but between scholars and conferences and lectures and so on. And at a certain moment, the EuroPem concentrated on students. And I think this is an enormous added value for students. The EuroPem, of course, is a pioneer, I would say. So, because nowadays you have the European Universities Initiative from the European Union of the European Commission, you have the Erasmus exchange programs and so on, but the EuroPem actually pioneered these kind of programs without calling them like that. And for students, of course, it's so important to have a different perspective. Only you already get a different perspective by going to another country, and bringing students together from different countries. You get, yeah, more different perspectives, and you get more international skills and so on. And this is what you cannot achieve locally. You have to collaborate with leading European universities, and that's enormous added value for students, and we should take on. They take with them these experiences for the rest of their lives. Should not underestimate the impact you have as a as an organization, doing these things like summer schools and well, all the kind of activities you do for students.
And by implication, do you think that some of the other, without criticizing them necessarily, but some of the other arrangements that now exist at European level, bringing universities together, aren't sufficiently student focused? Or do you think this is the kind of niche activity that the EuroPem should specialize in? And then a kind of parallel question. I mean, in the course of your own academic career, do you feel that university administration has become increasingly dominant and to some degree, a kind of drain, if you like, on the central role that universities should play, which is clearly in terms of educating and training young minds so that they are as open and as intellectually fertile as possible?
Well, there are two different questions. So the last one, I take up the last one, and I always defend, in a way, the administration. I've been a part of the administration, of course, of universities. I think the complexity of a university nowadays, even taking looking back at 25 years, the world has become, and especially the world the universities are operating in, has become much more complex than it has been before. And also the pressures from government, It used to be that universities were supposed to teach students and to do some research. And now, of course, universities are responsible for the economic development of a region, or and so on and so on. So the pressure on a university has tremendously risen. The complexity has risen, and you need an administration to deal with that. Huh? So I always say that people at in departments and researchers sometimes underestimate or undervalue the fact that administrators keep away government in a way from the classroom. So they are dealing with all those external pressures and so on. You need people to do that. And well, complexity of course also means much more stakeholders and et cetera, et cetera. So I did defend actually the administration. It's not their fault that sometimes bureaucratic pressures on the university have become much more heavy than before. I think the other initiatives, yes, they sometimes resemble what the European is doing. So the European universities initiatives, they in a way try to also work for students. Sometimes they have joint bachelor programs or master programs. I think the niche of the European is the topic, the topic of Europe. So you bring together really dedicated people dealing with this, again, already still a broadly defined topic, but it's about European studies in a broad sense of the word, and you bring both scholars and students and PhD students together around that theme. I think that's the niche where European can still play a very powerful role in the landscape of all the initiatives which have emerged.
Now, the EuroPam has traditionally been focused on the humanities and social sciences, but as we know, the boundaries between those two broad disciplines and the rest of academic life are dissolving, partly as a result of digitization and technology, which is not only having an effect operationally, but it's also having a major effect intellectually. And I just wondered how you see the evolution of the EuroPam in the future. Would you see it still as primarily student-focused? Would you see it primarily still in the social sciences and the humanities? And how far do you think the central kind of role and mission of the EuroPam needs to be continuously updated with innovations of various kinds?
Well, yes, it's obvious, of course, that disciplines are evolving, but also the interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary developments at universities is something the European has to follow or even has to lead. And this, of course, means that you bring in other disciplines than just humanities and social sciences. Most of the time, it's the other way around. Huh? So the natural sciences are doing projects. And they think, oh, you actually need a social scientist or a philosopher or something like this, and about ethics and so on. So they use the social sciences, humanities as add-ons sometimes for their projects. So let's turn that around, and expand where we need to expand to address today's problems. Let's face it. I mean, if you talk about climate change or loss of biodiversity, those are also topics on the European policy level, for instance. And you need to know something about it if you want to, have good ideas and do good research. You need to know what drives biodiversity and so on. So you need a biologist to help you as a social scientist, as a political scientist, if you deal with these issues. So yes, so we will become more interdisciplinary, but I think the core of the issue, the core of the European still is European affairs. So again, in the broad sense of the word, but there are new topics around the corner, not just around the corner, they are right in the open to deal with. And you need some input and collaboration with other disciplines. Whether it should concentrate on students, I think yes. Students, including PhD students, But I think the networks which will evolve through this student-oriented approach can also, of course, stimulate research by more senior academics because, they are stakeholders in this this project. And one other thing which I think is very important is the which the Europeum is now starting is the alumni policy, because those alumni in 25 years' time will be your prime minister, or they will, or your professor, or and so those net if that network can be maintained through a alumni policy, then there will be a lot of spin-offs, policy-wise, but also research-wise. You don't have to do it yourself as the Europeum. Stick with your mission in a way. Be student-oriented, but those students will get older, and if you keep them together through an alumni network, other things will emerge without the you doing, as a European, doing actively a research co collaboration. That's in a way, I think European should evolve.
That's great. Thank you very much, Wim. We really appreciate your joining us this afternoon. And with the forthcoming meeting coming up of the Academic Council, of course, we'll be operationalizing this very philosophy in terms of the decisions that we take about the way the Europeum moves forward. Thanks so much. And that's been the latest of our Europeum interviews.